Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents So, This Is Why I'm Broke, Lessons on Financial Literacy, Passive Income, and Generational Wealth by Melissa Jean-Baptiste, narrated by Deanna Anthony. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to financial resources and an investing glossary present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction. At 21 years old, I was a first-generation college graduate with not one, but two degrees, yet everything I knew about money could fit on an index card. 4 years later, when I attempted to buy a house, I quickly learned everything I actually knew about money could be summed up on a single Post-it. As a Haitian-American woman, former New York City high school teacher, and self-proclaimed wanderlust, I can 100% say I have lived and have the stories to prove it. Taking public transportation in New York City alone has provided me with an ample supply of "you won't believe what I just saw" moments for a lifetime. I jumped out of a plane, wrote an award-winning web series, visited 16 countries, traveled to 25 states, bought a house, and paid off $100,000 in student loan debt, all before 35 years old. Of all the unique things about me, my lack of financial literacy was not one of them. According to the 2014 S&P Global Financial Literacy Survey, only 57% of U.S. adults are financially literate. For a long time, I was a part of the 43% of people navigating my finances without an understanding of the four basic financial concepts assessed in the survey: risk diversification, numeracy, inflation, and compound interest. In 2013, I tried to buy a house with $0 in emergency savings and no idea how to calculate my net worth. The realtor, who lives rent-free in my mind, might I add, deflated that fairy tale rather quickly. "Your debt-to-income ratio is too high. You won't be pre-approved for more." Did I know what debt-to-income ratio meant? No. Was I furious that he wouldn't help me get pre-approved for $1 million to buy the house of my dreams? Yes. Talk about being completely out of touch with my financial reality. Unfortunately, I am not alone in this. You've probably heard some version of the widespread Jim Rohn quote, "We are the average of the five people we spend the most time with." My Biggie versus Tupac. Mr. Belding versus Mr. Feeney. Stoop kids afraid to leave the stoop. My Space top 8. Harry Potter obsessed ass fell right into the law of averages as expected. While I like to think I have a diverse collection of dope ass people in my inner and extended circle, the fact remains that none of my friends knew anything substantial about money either. My two brothers and I grew up in a Black household, and not just any Black household, a Caribbean household. This came with its own set of rules and ideologies that superseded common law in traditional Black households. If you got a 99 on a test, the first question was always, "What happened to the other point?" The second question, "Who got the highest grade in the class?" You're at a large gathering? Every elder in the room must be greeted with the standard kiss on the cheek because in some way, shape, or form, they are related to you, even if they are not. Sleepovers? Out of the question. Even with rules that were stricter than necessary and utterly ridiculous justifications, my brothers and I had a great childhood. We were blessed with two hardworking immigrant parents who focused on providing their children with as many experiences and opportunities they never had. They gave us all the comforts they could afford and enjoyed watching us pursue whatever we dreamed of. And I seriously mean whatever we dreamed of. My 26-year-old brother has been DJing since he was 9 years old, and my father bought him his first turntables from a discount aftermarket electronics store on Jamaica Avenue. All they asked for in return was for us to be good people and do well in school. My parents created an environment that allowed for academic success and encouraged open dialogue. We were always told to use our heads to make calculated, smart decisions. So, you can imagine how embarrassed I was during my first week in college after overdrafting my account buying Coach sneakers at the mall. You would think I had more sense. Despite what my mom may humorously tell you, I was a parent's teenage dream. I'm the girl who convinced my first boss to hire 5 of my friends and me as camp counselors, even after I wasn't initially offered the job. I lived off Pringles and water my entire senior year so I could save to buy an iPod Touch and pay for my prom dress. I balanced extracurricular activities and a strenuous course load and graduated with a 5.0 GPA. There was no way I should be overdrafting my account to buy sneakers because I simply had to know better. So I tucked my tail between my legs, asked my dad to borrow $70 to bring my account out of the red, and vowed to make better money decisions. That vow lasted all of 6 months. After securing my first campus job in the spring, I ended up on academic probation. This meant my $7,500 merit scholarship, the one I earned with a stellar high school academic record, was about to be snatched away. I was mortified. Not only did my GPA drop below 3.0, but I also now had to figure out what I was going to do to come up with another $7,500 to cover more of the tuition I already couldn't afford. I come from a supportive and loving family. What I don't come from is a family rolling in dough. For all intents and purposes, I would never classify my family as poor. For most of my childhood and adolescence, we were a 2 middle-income family. We were too wealthy to receive government assistance, but just broke enough to live paycheck to paycheck. This is no anomaly. As of January 2022, 64% of middle-income earners making between $50,000 and $100,000 a year are living paycheck to paycheck. It doesn't stop there. The 50 to 90% of Americans also carry about $7.3 trillion in debt as of December 2021. America runs on Duncan and debt, and so did we. It's a precarious act to balance, so it is no surprise that we were always one big emergency away from financial ruin. Adding another $7,500 to the subtraction column of the budget wasn't an option my parents could take on. And at $7.15 per hour, neither could I. The average 18-year-old today could come up with 5 different side hustles to help supplement some extra cash. The average 18-year-old in 2007 was drafting a dramatic away message on their T-Mobile Sidekick. Me, I was that 18-year-old. I was scared, confused, and mostly embarrassed yet again. Thankfully, I got my shit together just enough to keep my scholarship. In true, dramatic Leo fashion, I overcompensated for my initial failures and took 18 credits a semester, went to school year-round, and bodied a 22-credit summer. All of this to complete my bachelor's and master's programs at the same time. Honestly, I just wanted to give my parents extra bragging points at the family gatherings. I loved hearing them speak about me to their friends because they did it with their whole chest. They were proud parents, and you couldn't tell them anything. On paper, I was a West Indian success story. I earned 2 degrees, secured a full-time teaching job right out of college, and paid my bills on time. All that was left to accomplish was to buy a house, get married, and have 2.5 kids. That would truly be the definitive moment where I could say I finally achieved the American dream, and I wanted it all by 25. Why? Because when you turn 25, you realize you're 5 years from 30. And if you're that close to 30, you're damn near 50. And there was no way I could justify sneaking out of my parents' house at night to go have sex in my car at 50. My joints just weren't up for the job anymore. In all seriousness, when my mom was 25, she was already a wife and a mother. By the time she was 30, she was a mother of 3. Though she never explicitly pressured me to follow in her footsteps, The silent societal pressures were just enough to make me feel like I was 10 steps behind everyone else. So I put on my big girl pants, called a real estate agent, and learned a crucial lesson that day. I didn't know shit about money. I like to call that chapter in my life delusions of grandeur because I didn't know the first, second, or third thing about buying a house. When the agent asked me how much I saved for a down payment versus how much I saved for closing costs, my silence spoke loudly. The immediate answer was shame. The follow-up was not enough. If I told you my checking account had more than $2,000 in it at the time, I'd be lying to you and myself. I was in no position to buy anything substantial, especially not a huge financial responsibility like a house. As someone who is rarely ever stubborn, I pressed on anyway. The pre-approval process was even more embarrassing. I was approved for a $100,000 mortgage. Similar to the housing market today, NYC in 2013 was experiencing a severely overpriced seller's market. The median sale price increased 5.6% and hovered around $227,000. That $100,000 pre-approval wasn't going to get me very far. My immediate thought was, am I supposed to get a Barbie house with this? But my actual response went more like this. Why so low? I pay all of my bills. If he could respectfully laugh at that moment, I'm sure he would have. I would have too. Your debt-to-income ratio is too high. You have a lot of student loans. Of course I do. Who doesn't? What I didn't see was what he was seeing. He encouraged me to reach out to my loan provider and discuss options with them to help decrease my debt to have a better chance of getting approved for more money. The American way. Pay off some debt so you can have space to take on more debt. It makes sense, doesn't it? Was I disappointed? Absolutely. But that moment changed my life and financial trajectory. It's a big part of why I'm here writing this book for you. That moment forced me to start asking questions. Those questions led to answers that led to even more questions. If it weren't for that hard no, I would have never known that while I was out here frolicking, my student loan debt was ballooning. I learned about fancy terms, systems, accounts, and processes from people who were tone-deaf to the realities of the world. The nice, polished version of my story goes a little something like this. I paid off $102,000 in student loans on a teacher's salary. Over 9 years, I have gone from a negative net worth to a net worth of nearly $500,000. A picture-perfect started from the bottom, now we're here storyline. No Ivy League education, no trust funds, no high-paying job. Just a first-generation Black girl figuring it out on her own. And I don't want that for you. Oh, don't get me wrong. I want you to be filthy, stinking rich. Beyond rich. I want you and your entire bloodline to be wealthy AF. I want you to check in on your six-figure portfolio from a tropical island of your choosing. But I don't want you to figure it out for yourself. I don't want you to do it like me. I want you to do it 10 times better. That is what this book aims to do. Give you the tools, foundation, and support you need to manage your money better than the people writing books about money. You're getting the cheat code. This book is written by me to you to remind you that you don't have to feel ashamed or embarrassed by your financial mistakes. And as you've learned so far, I've made quite a few. They do not define you or your financial outcome. This book is deeply rooted in supporting your financial journey. My mission is to create a safe space for you to navigate through the financial concepts that are often purposely made difficult to understand. There's plenty of gatekeeping in finance, and there will be none of that here. From sinking funds to investing strategies, I've laid it all out for you in a manageable and approachable way, wherever you are in your financial journey. Although I have learned a lot about money, it was rarely, if ever, from anyone who looked or sounded like me. It never felt like my intersectionality was acknowledged in big conversations or addressed in financial policies. Most discourse centered on having money or not having money. You were either financially literate or weren't. I sure as hell never felt like I would ever have a seat at the fancy finance table. So, future millionaires, hear me when I say this book is for the culture. The fact that you are listening to this book right now means it is on the table. So, pull up and grab a seat. Part 1. Financial Fundamentals. Eating Costco samples for dinner so you don't have to. Chapter 1. My budget got left off bad and bougie. You know those people who wake up on a Tuesday and decide to just quit their job, pack a duffel bag, and move to Australia? Those free-spirited, everything-works-out-for-a-reason people whose lives are filled with romance and adventure? You know the type of people I'm talking about. Even if you don't know them personally, which, surprisingly, I do, you've probably seen some version of that person in a movie. Eat, pray, love, anyone? I find myself asking the same question every time. How did they budget for all of this adventure? And while that ever so sexy question may not be at the forefront of the film director's mind, it is a question I want to bring to the forefront of your mind. Let's not mince words here. The price of everything, especially rent, is too damn high. Inflation is a hot financial topic that's top of mind for many people right now. Rightfully so. With wage growth currently averaging 5.1%, abysmally trailing behind inflation that has hovered between 6.0 to 9.1% over the last 14 months. Simply put, it is becoming more and more difficult to make ends meet. Therefore, it only makes sense for us to start Chapter 1 discussing budgeting strategies to meet your everyday needs. It is an imperative financial routine that is crucial to your financial success. And since it is the foundation, we must make sure it's strong so you don't have to have dinner made up of free samples from Costco. Speaking from experience, trust me, it's not lit. What does every great and not-so-great romantic comedy have in common? That awkward first encounter between the two romantic leads where they stumble through the entire experience. Sometimes they'll quite literally bump into each other on a random street. Other times, their best friends fix them up on a blind date. No matter how they meet and the rom-com formula proceeds to wind through the cat and mouse. Will they or won't they get together at the end process? Sometimes they don't, and most times they do. I have something surprising to tell you. The rom-com formula we all deeply love or hate is the exact same formula used to budget. Say what? In fact, rom-com writers stole the entire budgeting flow word for word, bar for bar. Okay, I wouldn't take it that far, but budgeting can be as simple as a basic romantic comedy plotline. So where do you begin? You begin with the first date. You are going to take yourself on a money date. The best part about this date is you can order whatever you want. It can be any day of the week, at any time of day. You can choose to be as swaggy as you'd like or show up in sweats. The most important part is that you show up. You cannot cancel this date. This is going to be your first money date with yourself. So, let me show you exactly what you need to do to ensure this date successfully leads to a second date. Money Dates 101. Your first money date is going to be a little nerve-wracking. There is a level of financial vulnerability you're about to subject yourself to that you may have never experienced before. A little stress and anxiety about the numbers are completely normal. You are learning to navigate a new relationship with your money, and you are allowed to do so in a shame-free, comfortable environment. Step 1. Make space for yourself to be financially vulnerable. This means one of two things. 1. Choose a physical space that brings you comfort and minimal distraction. That can be your bedroom, office, living room, park, library, etc. Wherever you choose, make sure you're 100% comfortable unpacking your finances in that space. Personally, I love having money dates in my house with my dog curled up at my feet and a pizza slice in my hand. 2. Money dates can be uncomfortable, so it is important to remember to be honest. Whether it is your first or 50th, it can be difficult grappling with your financial status no matter how good you get at it. I teach people about personal finance all the time. I talk about money every single day, and I still have those WTF happened moments during my money dates from time to time. The discomfort is normal. Perseverance is key. Step 2. Grab your financial documents and make them easily accessible. What do I mean by financial documents? Every institution that gives you money or takes money from you is going to provide a record of that exchange. So that means things like your monthly bank statements, credit card bills, and student loan documents. Pull up a copy of each and keep them in one organized space that you can quickly and easily access. If you receive hard copies, I suggest getting an accordion folder to house all your papers. If you're using digital statements, download the PDFs into a folder on your desktop as we prepare to move into step 3. Step 3. Grab a writing utensil and let's do some math. I am not a fan of math in the slightest bit, so I promise we won't be doing too many complex math problems during our time together. So, once we've got tackled this arithmetic, we'll move on to bigger and better things. It is time to calculate your net worth. Yes, I know it is 2023, so there are tons of apps that can do the math for you. In fact, I've shared all my favorite personal finance apps in the resources, which can be found in the print and ebook versions of this book, so you can use them as a quick reference. But what kind of teacher would I be if I didn't teach you the factors that impact the number you're about to see? A terrible one, and I refuse to be a terrible teacher on your money journey. Shall we begin? I like to get the bad news out of the way before hearing the good news, and that's the same practice I put in place when calculating my net worth. Always start with your debts. Take full stock of your liabilities by adding up any money you owe. Even if it's $100 you owe to Granny, if she is expecting repayment, add it to the total sum. As a millennial, riding until the wheels fall off, a few common liabilities that often impact net worth are consumer credit card debt, payday loans, auto loans, mortgages, medical debt, and good old student loan debt. Make sure you include only liabilities and not your monthly bills while looking through your financial documents. Your cell phone bill is not considered a liability. It is an expense. What is a liability? While the term itself is not as fancy sounding as, let's say, the word fiduciary may sound, a liability is simply a fancy word for debt. To increase your exposure with Money Talk, I'll always provide the layman's term first, but I also want to give you opportunities to put the fancy terms into practice too. So, for those purposes, let's refer to debt as a liability for the remainder of this chapter. Liabilities often reveal many things about your relationship with money. The more liabilities you have, the harder it is to budget, build assets, and pursue financial freedom. Then you add in a sprinkle of immense out-of-pocket inflation. Forget about it. Inflation often causes liabilities to cost more in the long run than they traditionally would during times of economic prosperity. At this point, you're probably fed up with this money date, and you have every right to be. But the financial breakthrough you're preparing for comes on the other side of that frustration. We started with the bad news first for that exact reason. No one likes to add up their liabilities, but you cannot calculate your net worth without it. I sat down with Michael James, affectionately referred to as the Bougie Budgeter, to discuss one of her largest financial milestones, growing her net worth from negative to positive. As the founder of BougieBudgets.com, an online platform dedicated to teaching young professionals how to finance their best lives, I asked her about the key turning point in her personal finance journey that helped her grow her net worth. She stated, A lot of us are starting with a financial net worth that is lower than zero. You should always remember that no matter where you are starting from, it is not where you are ending. When making the decision to change your financial net worth, you have two choices: pay down debt or increase your investments. Think about what strategy will give you flexibility. Paying down debt can feel rewarding, but increasing investments was the way that provided me with more options for growth. So, what's next? You're going back into your financial documents to add up the value of all the things you own. We are going to call these items your assets. Common assets that traditionally impact net worth are real estate, vehicles, investment portfolios, checking, savings, and retirement accounts. You now have two numbers in front of you. Your assets equal all things that hold monetary value. Your liabilities equal your debt. There's just one more mathematical step to take. Subtract your liabilities from your assets. That final number that you're left with is your net worth. I'm not a betting woman, but if I had to take an educated guess, I'd say you're feeling one of two things right now. You're either pleasantly surprised or unbelievably mortified. Personally, the first time I calculated my net worth, I felt the latter. Why? Because my shit was hella negative. When I sat down to calculate my net worth, I don't know why it never crossed my mind that the number could be negative. After adding up my assets, my 2009 Nissan Altima, the $2,000 in my checking account, and my 403B, and subtracting my student loans, I had a net worth of negative $56,000. The all-too-familiar shame and embarrassment crept in immediately as the tears flowed freely. There it was, right in front of me in bold-ass black and white. I was literally worthless. Needless to say, I was ready to call that money date a wrap and relinquish myself to the idea that I permanently messed up my life and could never do anything to fix it. I was too far behind, so the only option was to keep putting on the same facade of success in front of my friends and family. As trash as I felt, that potential reality was far worse than admitting I didn't know what I was doing or how I got there. So, I chose, after many, many days of tearfully feeling sorry for myself, to continue the money date. It took me a while to internalize the actual truth of that matter, which was, yeah, this is where I am, but this is not where I'm staying. So let me share that with you again. Repeat after me. Yeah, this is where I am, but this is not where I'm staying. Honestly, if you want to repeat it one more time for good measure in your best British accent, that will probably help it stick a little stronger. The first money date must continue even when you don't think it's going well. Ready? Let's go get 'em. Step 4. Get to know your numbers. Calculating your net worth is the appetizer on your money date. Now we must transition to the main course. This step can be done in a multitude of different ways, but the process will always lead to the same outcome. The primary goal of step 4 on your money date is to obtain a dynamic understanding of your full financial landscape. You're going to need your financial documents again for this step. If you like writing with pen and paper, you can use the free expense tracker provided on SoThisIsWhyImBroke.com. When I started taking myself on money dates, old school pen and paper helped me focus in on what I was spending versus what I was saving. As I started going on money dates more often, I shifted into digital spreadsheets I filled out and stored on my tablet. So even if you start tracking your expenses one way, it doesn't mean you have to stick with that one way forever. The four main buckets you will initially focus on are 1, income. 2, saving, investing. 3, housing. 4, food. These four expense categories are the big key players in your budget, followed by expenses regarding healthcare, transportation, personal and family care, and debt. Whatever expense tracker you choose to use, make sure it gives you the opportunity to fill in all the aspects of your finances. Use your most recent documents to focus on the four main expense buckets before branching into the ancillary expenses. Your documentation should reflect your spending and
sample complete. Ready to continue?